In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
And welcome. So glad you're joining us today. As every week, we help you get a little more intelligence on big government. We are in our 12th year being on the air, and that has always been our focus, big government. We have always been about the government that governs least, governs best. Not what we have now, which is a government that seeks to control every aspect of your life. That is not what our founding fathers intended. They did not throw off one monarchy to exchange it for another. You know, looking back over the years that we've been on the air, there have been many gems that have always stuck with me, and one is an interview with Representative Ken Ivory back when he was leading the American Lands Council. I'd asked about an environmental policy's consequences for farmers and whether it was unintended or whether it was intentional, a conspiracy. And he said, it doesn't matter if it's a conspiracy. The effect is the same. I'd like you to keep that gem in mind during today's show. It doesn't matter if it's a conspiracy. The effect is the same. But speaking of, have you ever thought maybe we'd be less prone to believing in conspiracies if our government stopped committing them? Maybe we'd be less prone to believing conspiracies if our government stopped committing crimes and then telling us not to believe the evidence of our own eyes. Forget what you saw, believe what we tell you. Maybe we'd be less prone to believing conspiracies if the CIA and other agencies didn't have entire fields of study devoted to mind control, and specialists to study and refine and use it to control population through propaganda, to committing disinformation, to undermine the rule of law through false flags and provocateurs. For a while, our own government was just fine with the euthanasia, exterminating thousands of undesirables. Our government has routinely experimented on our own citizens and lied about it. The Tuskegee syphilis experiments, radiation experiments on American soldiers shortly after World War II. Now the vaccines. The same government that routinely sees American citizens as expendable wants you to not believe in conspiracies. And even if they're not conspiracies, the effect is the same. We have a split show this week. Real School Choice in Oregon is once again trying to bypass the government that would sacrifice children's education to protect their own power base. And then we'll have best-selling author Scott McGeown on to talk about the truth about January 6th. I'd like to welcome Mark Thielman back to the show. He is a former Republican candidate for Oregon's governor and now stepping back into the private world as a consultant. Mark, it's great to talk to you again.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, in our minds, you were clearly the best candidate for the job. Can you talk to our audience a little bit why the Republican voters at large didn't seem to see it that way?
Well, you know, when you're dealing with 19 candidates, obviously, it became an issue of how do you get into everyone's living room? And, you know, my campaign was very successful in the sense that, you know, I generated a lot of votes with very little funding. So I was completely grassroots. So we did a very good job, but it's hard to get out to 4.3 million people. And, you know, the analytics that I've received have been also reassuring because basically, you know, had I had $1 million to advertise, the outcome would have been very different.
Yeah.
And really, it was a matter of anyone who's ever seen me speak or saw me speak tended to, you know, gravitate to my campaign. And so, you know, this is a lesson learned for me. But at the same time, it's opened up a lot of doors because my campaign did well enough that, you know, Christine Drazen and Betsy Johnson in particular have been in contact and people want me to support them and work with them. So good things will come from all this.
Well, I certainly hope so. But clearly the answer is that more people need to be listening to iSpy Radio. But setting that aside, my personal observation is that, you know, you got organizations like the ORP. They continue to not like grassroots candidates while claiming that they want the grassroots involved. And what they really want are political slaves or at least minions to go out there and do the grunt work as the grassroots so that they don't have to do that or pay for it and to get the appearance of organic support for their candidates. What are your thoughts on that? Am I right or wrong?
Well, I think I mean, you know, I mean, I think you're being an awful direct, but I think there's a lot of truth in what you're saying. So, you know, everyone says they want grassroots, but grassroots can be difficult to control. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what creates the dichotomy that you just described. And so I think what we really do need as a unified party is that we need to understand that the grassroots is the majority of the Republican the party, or the red wave that's brewing, that Bridget Barton, for example, alluded to. And that we're going to have to do things a little differently if we want to have a more focused charge, if you will, because the Democrats rely on conservatives being splintered and divided. And yes, we really do need to find common ground together and try to bridge some of these gaps.
Well, I certainly agree with that on the splintering and dividing. In fact, it kind of makes you wonder if some of that was designed from the get-go. You mentioned Bridget Barton. She has now bolted for somebody that is a allegedly conservative writer with conservative solutions. Her solution is to abandon ship and throw in with the Democrats, who are not conservative. And so this made the news this week that she is now supporting Betsy Johnson rather than the Republican candidate. Talk to us a little bit about what you know about that situation.
Well, you know, I had sounded the alarm to the Drazen campaign a couple weeks prior to yesterday's announcement, and I was really surprised that they seemed like, huh? You know, and this goes back to what we should never assume. We should never assume that just because someone's a declared conservative that they're going to stay in the boat. And it goes back to that splintering thing. Mm-hmm. So obviously, Bridget Barton and Christine Drazen got into a bit of a kerfuffle there just before the primary. And there were accusations and news, you know, coverage accusing each campaign, accusing the other. And I think that contributed a little bit to Bridget's defection, if you will, to Betsy Johnson.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's sad to see. And just to speculate, of course, it does kind of make one wonder if that was the plan from the beginning. Get enough viable candidates in the race, split the votes, let the weakest of those candidates through, and then throw in with the third party candidate to dilute the Republican vote in the general. I mean, that's the kind of thing Democrats would scheme up. Not saying that that is necessarily what happened, but the effect is the same. And it's really too bad too bad. Once again, we're in exactly as you said, this splintering and dividing.
Yeah. And so, you know, and it's a tough thing because, you know, when you look at my grassroots base of support, you know, 30,000 votes and huge grassroots organization and people who were on my team. The vast majority were not paid. They were true believing people. And now both Betsy Johnson and Christine Drazen, you know, they're looking at the playing field and they're saying, wow, you know, it'd be great to get the Mark for Oregon people on board. And to me, you have to give people from Mark for Oregon something to get on board with. And
right.
So I'm engaging in those conversations and we're making some progress, you know, and here's why, you know, it's just what you said. Republicans make the mistake time and time again of trying to moderate their platform in order to get crossover votes. And my message has been very clear that we start as conservatives and we compete in the general as conservatives and we give a clear choice. And so we're making some progress, especially from the Drazen camp on that I was able to have some good conversations with Christine. She asked for my input and advice, and that's the advice I gave her. And she actually suggested that that's actually kind of the plan.
Good.
So I'm hoping that she can now that she's not a representative and doesn't have to, is not in the minority trying to do, you know, laws and legislation, I'm hoping she can come out as a firm conservative, yeah, and give the voters of Oregon a real choice.
Exactly.
Because more of what we had is not going to work.
Yeah. Well, I certainly hope so. I hope that she can be a uniter rather than being a divider like Barton has just done. And it really is kind of odd that she would so easily jump ship. I mean, you'd have to wonder why she was running for the nomination of a party that she doesn't think can win. I mean, that's kind of an odd thing. But okay, let's go and take a break. Come back. We'll be talking about a new plan that Mark is pushing forward to get school choice on the ballot. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Mark Thielman. He's a former Republican candidate for Oregon's governor, and he is now stepping back into the private world as a consultant. And one of the things that he's doing right now is trying to get real school choice on the ballot. And so, Mark, remind us what happened last time. They said it dealt with two issues. Why did they say that, or was it simply a splitting hairs situation that they're going to do anything they can to keep it off the ballot?
Well, and yeah, it was clearly a splitting hairs thing. There was no judicial review that's normally required. This is just something that the Secretary of State did because she got orders from her minions at the union. The public teachers union was the only one that created public testimony in opposition. And so what you do is we had some follow-up meetings afterwards after she had thrown it out, saying that it changed two aspects of the Constitution, which isn't allowed. So what we did is we just said, okay, rather than fight this and go through a long protracted court process, we'll create two petitions. so that's what we did. And so we have two petitions out, one that creates basically an open enrollment so that you can, if there's district next to you has room or a school that you were hoping to send your kid to has room, you can have your child transfer there and they can't say no as long as they have room. If they don't have room, they can say no, but that it's a beautiful process. So very similar to the way charter schools, you can't refuse a transfer to a charter school unless they're full. A charter school is required to accept kids until it meets that threshold. So we're going to make that the rule so that parents have options and some flexibility to move their kid to the school of their choice. It's similar to the open enrollment law that the Democrats, raged against for years and eventually sunsetted. So that's number one. The other petition is very similar to it's designed to have the money follow the child. And it's similar to the previous one in which, if parents, a homeschool family can have two choices. They can just keep doing what they're doing and not deal with the government at all. But some families, because we had two camps, we had camps that said, we don't want anything to do with the government and we're wary of any connection. And we had others that said, well, I wouldn't mind accessing the funds as long as it was the government couldn't come into my home and try to regulate, the curriculum and all that. So. Right. We've put in some very careful language into this newest version, and it's some of the best language that we accrued from very, very, very bright people from all over the country. That it's kind of like what did LBJ say back in the Tonkin Gulf, right? It's like the bill he got was like grandma's nightshirt. It covers everything. So this is a constitutional amendment, and it says it's very clear that if a parent engages in accessing their money for their child, the government has severe limitations. It cannot go in and regulate religion or creed or anything in the home. And so that language is in there now. And this is something we put in based on feedback from our partners in the homeschool world, like in the Ocean Group. They were very critical naturally and very concerned, but instead of ostracizing them, we engaged with them and said, let's talk in depth about these concerns and how can we create some safeguards to protect families from government overreach regarding this. So that language is in the new version.
Was that protection not in the previous version?
It was, but it wasn't quite as detailed as what we wrote in here now. And
I see.
And I got to give our homeschool families here in Oregon, we had several that were just very anxious and very willing to talk to us about very detailed concerns. And, like I was telling, my crew, hey, our job is to listen and do. So we brought in some incredible legal language. We went to all 50 states. We borrowed language from other petitions and movements in other states. And we worked it into this constitutional amendment. A constitutional amendment is the highest level of protection we can provide.
Right.
And that's what's so beautiful about this one. So I'm anxious to see the hysterics that the Public Teachers Union and Shamia Fagan, the Secretary of State, try to pull on this next round here.
Well, you probably didn't include a comma when you should have, or there's a missing semicolon, that kind of thing. I'm sure that could do it. But in terms of the strategy to split the two, does that create a situation where both of them have to pass in order to get real school choice, or can each one essentially stand alone?
Each one can stand alone. That was another requirement. You know, we've had open enrollment before, but this is a little bit improved from what the legislature had passed back in 2011. And so this basically sets up a lottery system over the summer for any school that might be full. And if you have more on your waiting list, then all schools have to do a fair and open lottery, that kind of thing. And but, you know, if it wasn't to pass, then we would just keep moving forward with the transfer rules the way they are now, which is which gives districts a lot of leeway to not release kids, for example. In this case, this petition would require, if it's passed, school districts would be required to release the child so the parent can take the child to the school of their choice.
Hmm.
It's empowering of parents.
Well, and that's the important thing in all of this, for sure. So what happens if you only get one of them? Does that mean you just try again 2 years later, or what's the thoughts on that?
Well, you know, obviously some of that will cross the bridge when we get there. I'm pretty confident that we did our homework well and that they're going to have a much more difficult time. They're not going to be able to say, oh, it affects two issues, okay, out. They're going to have to go through the full process, and that means the Justice Department's going to have to do a legal review, and they're going to have to come up with a brief. I'm pretty excited about it.
Good, good.
And like I say, you know, we just keep working and with our eye on the goal. You have to be single-minded in this focus. But I think, you know, as much as I didn't appreciate the last petition, which was very good, being thrown out for nefarious reasons, I think what we've produced this time around is actually even better. So good things come from some of that. And if we have to go a third round, we will, because we have a dedicated funder, and we have a huge entourage of supportive parents out there.
That's so awesome. Cool.
Yeah, I'm confident.
Okay, let's go ahead and take a break. School choice could be on the ballot. We'll talk about some what-if situations coming up next.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show. You're listening to the I Spy Radio Show.
And welcome back. We're talking about school choice today, real school choice. We're doing that with Mark Thielman. He's a former Republican candidate for governor, and now he is spearheading the effort to get real school choice on the ballot. And so in terms of getting this on the ballot, where do things stand right now? I know you have to have an initial round of signatures. Where exactly is that?
Well, you need 1,000 signatures for each petition. And most people sign both, obviously. Currently, we have, I think, all total, we're pushing 400. And we just kind of just got started. There's more come in every day. A lot of people are mailing them in because, you know, it's last time we had it during fair season, and it was very easy to get the signatures. So a lot of single ones are coming in. Right now we're on track. We figure we'll have, we want 2,000 each. That way they can't play certification games and throw signatures out, just overwhelm that. So right now we're on track. We figure right after 4th of July, we should have them week after 4th of July, and we'll get them filed.
Is this a situation where people can download, is this a situation where people can download signature forms and then send those off to you? And if
absolutely.
So, how do they get those?
Well, there's a website that we set up, and it's kind of tricky because I got to make sure I give people the full information. So it's educationfreedomfororegon. So educationfreedomfororegon.com. There's a webpage that'll come up. You will click the petition link, and all of that, those options will be available, including a counter on, you know, the updated on as the signatures, the website updates as we upload signatures.
Okay.
So.
Okay. And if people miss that, we'll put that up on ispyradio.com as well. And so to get these amendments passed, you're going to need to convince Oregonians that the amendments are needed and valuable for Oregon, and especially future Oregonians. So what are some of the biggest hurdles or mental roadblocks that would prevent the average Oregonian from supporting these?
Well, obviously, funded opposition is always what you have to expect. And the teachers' unions, obviously, they have purse strings and deep pocketbooks. Mm-hmm. And I think most people have concluded they don't always tell the full truth or the truth. And so we are prepared for that. And again, we have some funders in line, and people are serious about this. So if we're successful, which we expect to be, and these things do go to the ballot, then we will be doing a formal advocacy campaign, and we'll have some resources of our own so that we can get out, get the message out to every parent and grandparent about as to why these things are important for the future of education in Oregon.
So you've got opponents who are financially tied to these public schools. They get all of their money through public funding. How have you thought about how they will try to attack these measures as though they're a horrible thing that a parent might actually want to put their child in a school that's performing well rather than be stuck in the one that they're currently in? So what are you envisioning for some of the lines of attacks on these?
Well, the lines of attacks will be the same. You know, we want to stay in charge. We want to control the curriculum. Parents are an obstacle. You know, the system's not broken, and then they'll run the misinformation thing. The reality of it is it's the opposite of that, that we have a system that is not meeting the needs of a huge portion of parents, that they're pushing curriculum and ideologies that are becoming divisive. I think that's no secret. And so the teachers unions need to figure it out, and they're not going to. So that's why these petitions are being created, because it is about parents. It's about natural rights, and it's about parents being engaged with their kids in their education. I mean, isn't that what you always hear from the OEA on their public service announcements? You know, we want parents involved, and yet the reality is the opposite.
Yeah.
So get ready for a dust up. But I am well qualified to check the union in a public setting. And I'm fully armed with both my education experience and also my legal acuity here that I've accumulated through this process. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, the people that are currently in charge, I guess the question that immediately pops in my mind is, if the current situation could be successful, why aren't they? I mean, Oregon is doing horribly in terms of schooling. We're consistently near the bottom. I think one ranking situation had us actually at the bottom. So why aren't they successful? Is it just simply money? Because, of course, that's what they always ask for, is more of it.
Well, there's never been more money in public education in the history of Oregon than there is today, right now. Between COVID funds and improvements in state funding over the last decade, it's never been more or better funded. And what are the results? So what you will hear if you talk to the ideologues, they will say, well, all those criteria are based on a systemically racist and bigoted system, so none of them apply. We're pushing equity. We're not teaching math in advanced math because it's racist, and that's what's better. It's going to build a better and more egalitarian and more equal society. The reality of it is it creates kids who can't.
Right.
It creates victimhood, and kids become rudderless, and parents become maligned and attacked, and it becomes they begin to fracture the very clientele base, if you will, the parents and kids that they're supposed to be serving. So the writing's on the wall. Our data polling that we've done shows a strong support for not only school choice, but for these two petitions as they're written. Parents would like to have the option to move their kid if there's room in a school that they think they would better serve their child. And that's a natural thing for parents to do. We in government, you know, and I say we with quotations, should support that.
Well, you would think, and also I think what needs to be pointed out to these people, that these ideologues that are in charge now, is this is a matter of equity. Right now, we do have school choice, but only if you're rich. And this would give every parent the opportunity to get good, real school choice for their kids.
Yeah. And, you know, creating access, creating options for all families is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And good as defined as helps those parents and those children find the program, the educational pathway and program
yes.
that best meets their child's needs. It's a beautiful thing.
Yep, it sure is. And be successful. Well, Mark, we certainly want to stay in touch with you as these go forward. And I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thanks for having me, you guys. It's a pleasure as always.
All right, stick with us. We're going to shift gears now. Coming up, best-selling author Scott McEwen and the truth about January 6th. You know, there is no clearer example of two different justice systems than the treatment of Antifa, BLM, as they repeatedly burned and looted and destroyed businesses and buildings, including federal buildings, as they allegedly protested George Floyd and other perceived injustices, and compare that to the treatment of January 6 protesters at the U.S. Capitol. To talk about all that, I'd like to welcome Scott McEwen back to the show. Scott, it is great to talk to you again.
Thank you for having me on, Mark. You know, I really appreciate it, I'm glad to be out here talking just like you are about the appalling atrocities that we're seeing right now from the federal government system.
Oh, it absolutely is. And looking at the January 6 protesters, yeah, there were some bad actors among them. Whether they were real protesters or not, or they were FBI agents is maybe another story. But, you know, even if you assume that all of them were bad actors there, it was a small minority out of the hundreds of thousands of people that were there. And what they did was absolutely nothing in comparison to the widespread looting and destruction and terror unleashed in these cities all across America. And yet these January 6 prisoners, they've been abused. They've been locked in solitary confinement. They've been denied medical treatment, denied access to religious leaders, even denied access to their own lawyers. Meanwhile, we got BLM, Antifa out there. A lot of times they weren't even charged. And even when they were, the charges were often dropped. I mean, we literally have
bail. And the other thing, too, that's important to remember, Mark, and I think this is possibly the most important thing is, you know, the United States set up a system of bail and the writ of the habeas corpus. Mm-hmm. And the writ of habeas corpus was developed way eons ago, literally hundreds of years ago, because of the British crime, the British basically royalty not allowing people to be brought out of jail or given bail to for their time before they're actually tried. And, you know, and here the writ of habeas corpus has been suspended indefinitely with people that at most probably, if anything, did misdemeanors. And so really what we've seen here is not only a miscarriage of justice in the actual charging of these crimes, but also in the fact that these people are not allowed bail and they're not allowed the writ of habeas corpus, which literally means bring the body to the judge. I want to rule on this case. And that's exactly what they need to do right now.
When you say it's been suspended, is that officially suspended or if it's just kind of an implied suspension?
Well, you tell me when people have been in jail now for what, over almost 20 months, you know, when we're talking about these individuals, they have been denied bail and they can get no relief under habeas corpus or with these acts that are being done with medical, et cetera, et cetera. That tells me that it doesn't exist. Now, you can say, oh, has it been officially denied? Has it been officially suspended? No, but that's exactly what's going on.
Yep, the effect's the same. What I find so absolutely horrifying in all of this is we have literally treated Al-Qaeda terrorists better than we have treated our own citizens here. The vast, vast majority of the people that were there to defend this country and our elections. And meanwhile,
yeah, exactly.
This is how we're treating these people.
Well, you know, it's carryover, and you know, and it really is emblematic, you know, if not an example of what we've seen with the entire federal court system in Washington D.C. Because all of the judges, virtually every judge that's a federal court judge in Washington D.C., are Democratic, and you know, are Democrats. And at the end of the day, these judges are willingly and openly just flaunting the Constitution of the United States, knowing that they were appointed by Democrat presidents. And the ones that are actually in power there, we've seen certain things, you know, with the trials that we've actually witnessed that have gone on, not only with this case, but with other cases, they're completely one-sided on what their approach is to the subject. Hence, they won't give these people bail, et cetera, et cetera. And it really shows a flaw in our system that the entire city of Washington, D.C. and its court systems are the swamp, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, I think the big question on everyone's mind is how is this allowed to continue in a nation in which you are allegedly innocent until proven guilty? I mean, you know, obviously these judges are able to get away with it because they're Democrats operating in a fully Democrat city there. But what's the legal ramifications? Why are these attorneys for these defendants not able to pry them out of these, like, if nothing else, out of solitary confinement and some of the other abuse that they've been suffering?
You know, that to me is the most troubling, because you know there's people out there that are fighting for these people, and they must be knocking their heads against the walls. Well, that case that you're talking about earlier, you know, obviously those attorneys are screaming to the high heavens. You know, the appellate courts are not taking these cases, you know, as quickly as they should. Because, you know, whatever the judges do at the initial level, at the trial court level, there is supposed to be an appellate system that says that those courts are going to review these cases, et cetera, et cetera. Ultimately, one of these cases is going to have to make it to the Supreme Court. And when it does make it to the Supreme Court, I think some law is going to have to be levied on what these judges are allowing relative to the treatment of these prisoners.
Is there some kind of legal means that they can use to pry that door open?
Well, it's the appellate system is pretty tried. I mean, I should say pretty set. So there are certain periods of time, unless you have an emergency, you know, you can prove an emergency, which I would argue this is an emergency, that these courts can do certain things. You know, realistically, Mark, what I really see here is nothing's going to happen until, you know, God be willing, we see a change in this entire Congress and hopefully the Senate of the United States coming in November. And then they realize that their days of darkness and ability to cover these crimes are going to end. Congressional committees are going to be appointed, and there's going to be a lot of people that are going to have to pay for what's going on.
Oh, I certainly hope so. Activist judges in the past have certainly thrown themselves onto these terrorist cases, you know, demanding basic human rights and to prevent even the appearance of abuse. So where are these activist judges not demanding rights for these prisoners? I mean, does it come down to that they're on the wrong side of political aisle? Because if that's the case, their demand for human rights rings pretty hollow and hypocritical if it depends on which side of the political aisle you're on.
Well, exactly. That's exactly what is happening here. Is these judges are definitely on the left side of the political aisle, on the Democrat side. And these judges don't want to hear it because this was an effrontery to their belief that Trump is bad. This is really a continuation of the whole message. Trump is bad. Trump caused this whole problem. We're going to punish these people for listening to the evil, if you will, that they believe Trump was. And so anybody that supported Trump, they want to openly punish and send a message to the American people. If you try this again, this is what's going to happen to you. Ultimately, that's what they're doing. There's no other conclusion can be drawn.
Oh, absolutely. I certainly agree with that. This is designed to prevent other people from rising up as well. But sadly, when it comes to human rights, it's the same mental gymnastics that they use to treat Jews one way and everyone else another way in World War II. Okay, everyone stay with us. There was an important documentary coming up about that just came out, actually, about the January 6th prisoners. Everyone stay with us. We'll be talking about that with best-selling author Scott McEwen. And welcome back. Scott McEwen is the New York Times bestselling co-author of American Sniper and has his own series of books, including the Sniper Elite series and Camp Valor, and some nonfiction books as well. Summer's coming up, and we highly recommend all of Scott's books. So, Scott, we sent you, as I mentioned in that last segment there is a documentary out about the January 6th prisoners, actually done and narrated by one of these prisoners, and this was horrifying. Why don't you give us your first impressions of that?
Well, my impression is, first of all, you know, when you look at the disparity of treatment of prisoners, you have to wonder to yourself why, you know, because what is exactly going on that the Department of Prisons, that these people that are jailing these individuals, these people that are asking for, you know, medical rights to be looked after, things of that nature, why in God's name are these people still in jail, first of all? And number two, why are these people treated the way they are without bail, without medical treatment, et cetera? I do not see a justification for this except the fact that this is a political prosecution. And we are supposed to be, as Americans, beyond political prosecution. Whether you agree or disagree with the crime, that's not the issue. The issue is, if the prosecution and the way they're being treated is for political reasons, then you have a problem under our system. And let me tell you something, it is obvious 100% these people are being treated as political prisoners and essentially being tortured as such.
Oh, absolutely. There have been cases of people being beaten, denied medication. There was one guy that was recently released because he was faring so badly. They had denied him his cancer medication. There is no logical reason that you would do that in America. You're talking political prisoners. I'm trying to think of another time in our history when we have treated political prisoners this badly. And I really can't think of any. I mean, we certainly didn't do this back in the 70s or the 60s when we had...
No, the Japanese internment, you know, the Japanese internment during World War II and the ultimate decision by our Supreme Court after overturning Korematsu versus United States was a dark time in our history. There's no doubt about it. We made some decisions there that were very, very emotional, very much, you know, based upon a war and the things that had gone on in that war. But you can almost see the reason for the emotion in that circumstance where the United States had, if you will, suffered a surprise attack at the hands of Japan, not these individuals, but the hands of Japanese, the Japanese, obviously, from the country of Japan. And so I guess there was some, if you will, ostensible reason for the fear. Here, we don't have that. This is pure political hatred. Mm-hmm. These people weren't armed. These people were beat down. The only people killed were people involved that were unarmed by the guards at the location, and yet they still treat these people as if they'd set off some type of a bomb or something in our nation's capital, which really did not take place.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just wondering, anything beyond the fact that if you question us, we are going to jail you and silence you, that is exactly the treatment these people are getting. That is all it is.
Absolutely. And you mentioned there with World War II, that was a declared war. I don't really see them as political prisoners. I see them more as, you know, the prisoners of war. I think that's a very different situation. But here, unless the Democrats have declared war on Republicans, I don't see any reason to be treating people, again, that were there to defend the Constitution this way.
Well, and the other thing, too, is, Mark, is one might argue, and I'm not suggesting anyone take up arms. Don't take this that way. But one might argue that the other side has already declared war if this is what they're doing with the people that disagree with them.
Right.
And that is an incendiary comment on my behalf to a certain degree. But I believe that the Democrats really view this as the beginning of a war and, you know, inside our own country. And that's what's really dangerous to me, is that if the courts don't stop this and do not put a very strong message on this, that look, we are not going to allow this type of action by one political party against a differing or disagreeing political party interest, then what is the difference? I mean, between being in an actual, if you will, a hand-to-hand combat or whatever else, they're just jailing the people on, if you will, our side that disagree with their side, because they have the ability to do so,
right,
given the fact that they have all three branches of government.
Right.
But hopefully, and I really believe this, hopefully that will change soon. And these people, if it should get justice sooner, but if no later than when the House and the Senate are taken back and Congress starts acting.
Well, I certainly hope that's the case there in November. As you say, they may not have declared war, but the effect is certainly the same. This is a really fascinating documentary. You can find it by heading to Gateway Pundit. We'll put it up on iSpyRadio.com as well. It's called The Truth About January 6th. It is narrated by Jake Lang, who is one of the prisoners there, and he's been in solitary confinement, he says, for over 17 months. It walks you through some of the events there, January 6th. It walks you through some of the treatment of people thereafter. But when you look at the events of January 6th, it is indisputable that it was the police that were removing the barricades. It's not like they were overwhelmed. They were removing the barricades. They waved people inside the perimeter. They opened the doors to the Capitol. I mean, it's shocking to look at that. Do you think that looking at the overall events of that day, do you think it was a staged event that they wanted people to go in there or that they were even incited to do so?
I've said this before on your show, and I've said it on other shows as well, and I believe it, truly believe it. And that is that not only was it a staged event, but that the fact that Nancy Pelosi and the Capitol Police did not, in fact, said they do not want help from the National Guard, which Trump requested 2 days before the event happened. He asked that the National Guard come there because he knew that people were upset, et cetera, and he wanted to keep order. The fact that they denied that, and the way that the feds were already embedded within these groups and part of the rabble rousers, which absolutely were trying to run up the crowd and make the crowd a more violent situation. I don't see what other conclusions can be drawn. I mean, but that this was a setup, and you know, and really, the people involved were pawns in the setup, because I don't think 99% of them had any intention of doing anything violent or doing anything illegal. But the bottom line is there was incentives tried to put out there by the people that are participating from the federal government, from the FBI, that were in these groups, undisputed at this time. And you know what? It was effective. Yeah. They got done what they needed to get done.
Well, I don't think we know yet exactly how many FBI informants were part of all of this. I don't think that we've gotten a peek yet at their documents that would have been necessary to pull all of this together and whatnot. I certainly hope that come after 2022 elections, we do get a peek at those. But I found it very interesting in that documentary, they played that clip there where Ted Cruz is asking a FBI spokesperson if there were federal agents actively participating. Did federal agents commit any crimes of violence? Did they encourage and incite crimes of violence on January 6th? And the spokesperson for the FBI said she can't answer that, and then can't answer that. I think that's exceptionally telling.
Exactly. Why can't you answer it? You know, it's amazing to me that they let them even get away with that response. You know, it seems to me that's contempt of Congress or the Senate, you know, period. But the bottom line is, especially as a federal official, the fact that you can't answer that, what does that tell you?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you would categorically deny it under any circumstance, you know, where there wasn't untoward behavior or illegal behavior, but they can't do it because, you know what, it's not true. And they don't want to be held, you know, they don't want to be held to have perched themselves in front of Congress.
Hmm. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break. We'll wrap things up with Scott McEwen after this, talk about January 6th. And we're back in our final segment now. We're on I Spy Radio. We're talking with Scott McEwen. We've been talking about the January 6th documentary that just came out, the truth of January 6th. And so, Scott, it is really just appalling right now what is happening in our justice system. You've got the FBI doing these false flag events where they're literally encouraging people to kidnap the governor of Michigan and saying, oh, gosh, you know, imagine how that happened. And yet you've got allegedly these white hats in the FBI or CIA and some of these other agencies. Where are they all?
Well, I think what's going on is, you know, I really believe this, that the majority of, and I can't say this about the agency, about the CIA, but I certainly can say it about the FBI. The agents that I know are really law-abiding individuals, and I believe they believe in the rule of law, and I believe they, you know, they try and go after the bad guys, and that's really their game plan. And I would say that about 90, you know, plus percent of them, 95% that I know of, are all of that belief. But I, you know, I'm also of the belief that the people that are in charge, and we saw it with Comey, we saw it with others that are currently in charge, unfortunately, you know, with, given this administration, et cetera, and, you know, with the acts of Peter Stroke and, you know, and the rest of them, Strozek or whatever, you know, that these individuals at the top are completely in charge of the rank and file, if you will, cops, you know, the FBI that go out and do the job on the street, et cetera. And the street cops, if you will, are overmanned, if you know, by the leadership, to the point where if they try and speak up, and I know this for a fact from some of the people I've talked to, if they try and speak up and say, hey, this isn't right, what's going on here, they are threatened with immediate retirement and or expulsion from the ranks of the FBI. And the retirement issue with the FBI is they get a huge retirement if they stick with that, with the group for a certain period of years, you know, probably the best in the federal government, certainly much better than the military. And they're outright just threatened that they're going to get thrown out of the organization and their retirement won't happen. So they're trying to keep these guys and threatening to make sure that those that are willing to tell the truth are willing to bring the truth, you know, to the courts, that they basically stay in line and stick with the rank and file.
Well, threatening them with the loss of their retirement, I could certainly see why that would handcuff a lot of these people. But, you know, and not to insult anybody that you know or any active agent out there, because I don't know the situation. But why isn't there some kind of operation to topple these crooks, to expose them, to investigate them just as they would any other criminal? You got Comey out there doing these false charges against Trump. He initiated Crossfire Hurricane after they found out from Brennan that the whole Russia collusion things was a hoax being perpetrated by Hillary. and yet he pushed that through anyway. So where's the operation to go after these crooks within their own organization the same way that they would go after any other crook?
Unfortunately, I'd have to say that where the sun current sets, it does not exist, Mark. It does not exist. There is no effort to clean up this group. You've seen no high-level firings. You know, not one of those people that were involved in the fake FISA warrants and the whole mess that we saw with Comey, et cetera, Strozek, et cetera, where they were caught lying, they were caught doing fake, you know, the whole thing was phony. Not one of them has been prosecuted. So I guess you have to say the conclusion that must be drawn is that there is no effort to try and clean this up.
It almost sounds like what you're saying is the FBI agents who would like to do something don't have faith in their own organization that should they were get them on wiretap, get them, you know, saying things or have documentation. It doesn't sound like they have faith enough in their own organization to bring these kinds of charges against them.
I would have to agree with you. Definitely.
And it is just horrifying that that's where we're at right now. We need people of courage to be able to step forward, and we need a system that will allow and encourage those people to have courage and step forward. So just to wrap things up here, with the January 6th thing, I mean, it's appalling, this show trial that the January 6th committee, the Star Chamber, is pushing out there. But it always comes down to me that the simplest point of logic is that Trump supporters are overwhelmingly pro-Second Amendment. If this was an insurrection, where were the firearms?
Exactly. Not one. The only thing they have that involved any firearm or any explosives whatsoever are these alleged pipe bombs, and nobody can even come to a conclusion on that. No one has been charged, notwithstanding the fact they supposedly had videotapes of the individual, et cetera, yep. Which tells me that's probably fake, too.
Yep, I think so as well. All right, Scott, unfortunately, we're up against the clock, but thank you so much for your time today. This has been great, as always.
Thank you very much for having me on. You guys, keep up the word. You know what? I'm not giving up. None of us can give up.
Nope.
We got to vote. We got to come through. We got to do what we got to do to save this country. And I'm telling you, it's imperative that people question every single thing coming out of this government right now and get ready to vote in November, because by gosh, we got to take this back. This is our last shot. Yep. We got to get it done this time.
That's for sure. Before we go, be sure to head to our website, iSpyRadio.com. That's the letter I. iSpyRadio.com. We have some important links for you. One is, if you want to help get real school choice on the ballot, they need to show an initial round of interest. You can download the signature forms and send them in to get past that first hurdle. Head to EducationFreedomForOregon.com. That's F-O-R, EducationFreedomForOregon.com. And you can also get links to Scott's books and a link to that documentary, The Truth About January 6th. Check those out, sign those petitions, watch that film, and share them. Because as we say every week, the best information is no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.